This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you so much. My name's Emily Sexton. I'm the head of programming for the Wheeler Centre. Thank you for coming along tonight. Our guest was born and raised in Southern California. She graduated from Stanford Uni and later earned her MFA in fiction at the University of Michigan, where she won a Hopwood Award in graduate short fiction, as well as the 2014 Hurston Wright Award for college writers. Her work is featured in The New Yorker, New York Times Magazine, Paris Review, and Jezebel. And The Mothers is, as we all know, her debut novel. Welcome, Britt Bennett, to Melbourne.
Thanks for having me.
So we're going to begin where you begin, which is with Nadia's decision to have an abortion. She falls pregnant to the pastor's son, Luke. And the difficulty of this experience for everyone sort of seeps throughout the novel and the community that surrounds it. Why did you choose to begin a novel like that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I always knew the point at which I started writing it that this was a decision that Nadia would make. I never envisioned a version of the novel where she decided to keep the baby. Mm-hmm. So I think one thing that I was thinking of was one of my favorite books is Song of Solomon by Toni Morrison. And that book begins with a guy leaping off a building. And it's a really shocking way to start. But it was something that always really struck me as being really interesting to begin with this sort of big dramatic decision and this big dramatic image. So I think because I always knew this is what the character would do, and because I like the idea of beginning with something bold, I was always drawn to the idea of starting there.
But it's really beginning with an end,
yes.
In a sense.
Well, it begins kind of with two ends, both her mother's suicide, which is kind of lingering in the background, and her decision to terminate this pregnancy. And I think there was something about that was kind of difficult from the craft standpoint, because mm-hmm. you're beginning with an end. I think that there are a lot of reasons why you have a lot of pregnancy storylines, but one really obvious reason is that pregnancy generates story. Because if you have a pregnant person, then you have, there are stages of the pregnancy, and the pregnancy progresses, and then eventually you have a child, and what's that child going to be like, and you have more story, right? But when you begin with an abortion, that's the end of a story. So I remember when I was writing it, I had several people tell me, like, what? Just don't start there. Like, start earlier, start at some other point, but I knew this was a decision she would make, I didn't want to write the story where for 50 pages she's waffling about what to do. I was actually really interested in what happened after that story ended and the new story that was going to start.
Mm. What I love about it is the respect that it demonstrates for the reader, that they want to be with you in the hard stuff, you know.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you to do a reading that is
sure.
About 50 pages in and is about the aftermath. The beginning of the aftermath.
Sure. That night, before falling asleep, Nadia opened her nightstand and felt around for the baby feet. A gift, if you could call it that, from the free pregnancy center after she'd learned that her test was positive. The counselor, Dolores, gave her a plastic bag full of pamphlets with titles like Caring for Your Preborn Baby, Secrets of the Abortion Industry, and Can the Pill Kill You? Under a handout titled True Love Waits, the counselor had tucked a purple Precious Milestones card, explaining the stages of a baby's development week by week. Attached to the card was a lapel pin, a pair of tiny golden feet, in the exact shape and size, Dolores told her, as those of her own 8-week-old baby. Before leaving, Nadia had thrown up quietly inside the clinic bathroom. Then she dumped the pamphlets in the trash, shoving all of them through the narrow slot until she reached the card on the bottom, the one attached to the baby feet. She had never seen such a thing before, a pair of disembodied feet, and maybe the sheer oddness compelled her to keep the pen. Or maybe she had known then that she would have an abortion. She had felt her choices strung in a tight balance, and when she hadn't been able to throw the pen away, she knew then that there would be no baby, that this pin was all that would remain. She had hidden the lapel pin in the back of her drawer, past old notebooks and hair ties and an empty jewelry box her father had bought her years ago. Every night before bed, she dug through the drawer for the pin and held it in her palm, stroking the bottom of golden feet still glinting in the dark.
Ugh. Thanks, Brid. Where did that image of the pin come from?
I think that was actually something I found online. Right. I did a lot of sort of deep diving into a lot of, I guess, the apparatus surrounding abortions. So not just what happens at the clinic, but all of these other things that sort of surround it. So, you know, there are some states where, for example, a doctor has to describe to you in detail what the procedure is like. Or there are all these different laws that are sort of in place to deter women from having abortions. And I don't remember where I stumbled upon this, but these cards that show you sort of the development of the baby and the feet, and that's meant to be something, again, to deter you. And I like hate that type of thing. Like, I don't know if you've seen Juno.
Yeah.
But I love that movie, Juno. But I hate the moment where she decides not to have the abortion because she like learns that her baby has toenails or something, and that like is enough to stop her. And I don't mean to judge that. That's a fine personal decision. But there's a way in which the sort of this idea of sort of making a fetus feel more real or feel more baby-like is sort of used to deter a woman.
Oh, it's manipulative.
Right, it's super manipulative. And again, this is a 17-year-old girl who's just lost her mother and does not want to have a baby. So I'd sort of done this deep dive and found a lot of these, like a lot of those pamphlets, those are real pamphlets that exist that, can the pill kill you? Yes, that's real. That are given out to people at these clinics and the idea that a lot of these crisis pregnancy centers are really just sort of meant to manipulate women into not terminating their pregnancies. So I found when I saw that pin of the baby feet, I found it so strange. But I really liked the idea of Nadia keeping it as like this is the only thing that she'll actually keep to remind her of this decision that she's made.
Mm. The way that this her decision plays out is often in a lot of sort of secrets, and the way that the characters withhold different kinds of information from each other. How do you think secrets operate in storytelling?
Yeah, I mean, I love secrets. probably not surprising if you've read the book. I think secrets are really interesting because revealing them creates intimacy. That's often when you've told somebody a secret that brings you closer together, and when you keep a secret from someone, it keeps you apart. So I think secrets can kind of create a type of tension. I also think secrets can propel a story forward and create energy. But I also think I'm wary of stories that use secrets to be sort of coy. And that's what I didn't want to do. So in the opening, I don't know, two pages, I give you a lot of information just up front. I tell you that her mother's dead. I tell you how her mother died. I tell you that she's pregnant, who the father is, that she doesn't keep the baby. And I think there are a lot of versions of this book that could have kept some of those things secret for longer. But I had this teacher at Michigan who told me once that stories create mystery by revealing information, not withholding it. And that's something that's really true. I think if I would have, for example, withheld the fact that she has this abortion, the way that the opening of that book reads would be very different. You're not as interested or as invested in her. So I like the idea of just putting a lot of information up front. I think it is a sign of respect for the reader and the reader's time, but I also think it actually makes the story more interesting by telling people things.
For sure. One of the things that struck me, and I hope we're the same age, so I hope this doesn't come across as patronizing, but the maturity of observation in your writing, you know, I have a kid, so there are things that you seem to know that just floor me that I didn't know when I was 26. And the empathy and kind of understanding that you write with, I wondered whether that came from a lot of time that you might have spent with your elders and who they were in your life.
Yeah, I mean, so I'm the youngest person in my family. My parents had me at an older age, so my parents are baby boomers, both in their 60s. I have one sister who's 10 years older than me. And I have another sister who's 2 years older than me. Mm-hmm. But I've basically been spent a lot of my time in the company of people who are older than me and in various degrees. Mm. So I think that has been part of my interest. I feel much more comfortable writing about older people than children, I've realized. although I'm closer to childhood, but when there are scenes in like a rehab center, my grandpa, who's no longer with us, he had a stroke one summer and had to go in this rehab center, and I was spent a lot of time there with him, and observed a lot of these older people that were there and spent all this time talking to him. So I think I feel a deep respect and affinity for older people in a way that I really struggle to write children and have kind of stopped trying to. So I think a lot of that comes from just being the kid in the room overhearing people gossiping and talking and not really paying attention to me because I was so young.
Because gossip and you know, that notion of, you could have chosen an unreliable narrator, but instead you went with this sort of other convention of a Greek chorus, and we touched on secrets and gossip, and they are characterized as sort of the elder women of the church. Why did you choose that Greek chorus convention?
I think it was something that I kind of stumbled into. It wasn't originally part of the book. And I was just writing in this voice that felt a lot older than the characters. And I started to think, maybe about a year and a half before I finished the book, what would happen if this older voice was actually located in characters. And I was drawn to the idea of these church mothers, because there are these women who are sort of dismissed for being kind of gossipy and they're busybodies, but actually end up having great power because they're the ones who structure the story that's being told. And I think I've always had a heart for these elder women. I grew up in the church, and I've always, you know, noticed how 9 times out of 10 women do so much of the labor that makes churches run. I mean, a lot of organizations, but churches in particular, they do a lot of this labor that's kind of invisible. But the person who gets to be very visible and stand up on the pulpit is usually male. But I thought about the women who, you know, the women doing bake sales and organizing things and doing all this work that really makes the church run are often women, and often older women. So I had a lot of empathy for these women who were kind of dismissed and overlooked, but end up being powerful because they get to structure the story that's being told.
That's a big thing for you. Who gets to sort of, determine the truth of a scenario, or determine the truth of the power in the situation?
I mean, I think so. I think gossip is really interesting to me in particular because it's often a mode of communication that's sort of subversive, and it's often associated with people who don't have a lot of actual power, who don't have a lot of sort of institutional power necessarily. I think that's one reason why it's often associated with women. But the idea of gossip is extremely powerful because gossip is sort of constructing a story about somebody without their consent. And that story could be true, that story could be fake, but you are the person who gets to write the story of some other person and pass it along. And in a sense, it's kind of what we do as writers. But I've always been interested in that as a mode of communication. And again, the way that these women who don't have a lot of institutional power are powerful because they are gossiping about these characters.
Mm. You mentioned that you grew up in church and you still attend church?
I do sometimes, yes. I grew up kind of between a couple churches. So my dad's Protestant and my mom's Catholic. So I grew up kind of going between both, and I've always been very interested, I think, in religion through that background. The church my mom went to was mostly white and Filipino, and the church my dad went to was mostly black.
They went to different,
they've been married 30 years, like they're still married, but my mom grew up Catholic and was, you know, and now they kind of go to the same church. My dad's church sort of won out in this way. so now they go to my dad's church mostly, but I kind of grew up with those different backgrounds, and it's something I've been increasingly realizing about myself, just sort of the strangeness of that maybe. But I've always been interested in seeing how different people express faith in different ways.
What line do you draw between that kind of context that you grew up in, the religious context, and I guess your own faith as it exists, and then addressing these really difficult subjects, abortion, suicide, adultery, is it back in the novel too?
Yeah.
Homosexuality, you know, like these things that the church, if you can define it as a soul entity, you know, has evolved in some corners and right. not in others.
Well, I mean, my parents have always been a lot more conservative than I am. And
that's unusual.
Yeah, surprisingly. And I think that when I started writing this book, I think a lot of that was me sort of pushing back against the sort of doctrine that I'd been handed down. And I think there are some ways in which my parents, their thoughts have changed since then. Like I think my mom in particular is more supportive of same-sex marriage than she used to be. And there are some areas in which the needle has sort of moved over time. But I think a lot of it was kind of me being like a kid and like, okay, screw you. I'm going to like throw in all of these things that I've been told are bad and add it into the book and see what happens.
And what did happen? What do they think of your book?
Well, I think they're happy about the book. They're happy it's out. They're supportive of it, in theory. But I've heard my dad like describe it to people, and he always like adds disclaimers of like, now, you know, it's kind of rated R, so, which is just like funny. And I don't think of it as being that obscene, but my parents don't even really like movies with a lot of cussing, so they're pretty conservative in their values and their aesthetic. So they're supportive, and you know, my dad got all his friends to come to the event and everything, and they've been pushing the book in everyone's hands, but still a little conservative for, I guess, my work.
I'm interested then, yeah, sticking to this subject of faith, the choice that is made by Luke's parents, that is another one of these choices that then kind of echoes throughout the novel. Is it wavering faith, or is it sort of parental protectionism, or is it just hypocrisy? What are they,
I think initially I meant it as hypocrisy, which again, like me
this being, is a choice for them to pay for the abortion.
Right. And I think initially that revelation came at the very end of the book.
Uh-huh.
And it was one of these like gotcha moments of like, guess what? You know, they knew all along and they paid for it. Aren't people hypocritical? Which was like the level of sophistication of my thought, like when I started the book.
Which was what, 19?
It was like 17, 18. 17,
right.
Yeah. So that was like where I was.
Mm-hmm.
But I think again, over time, realizing that things are more interesting when you reveal them. So that revelation is moved much earlier in the book now. So realizing that every interaction, after you know that information, every interaction with these characters is much more interesting because you know that they've done this thing. But also asking myself that same question, why did they do this? And like hypocrisy is not interesting. That's not an interesting answer. People are hypocritical. We all know this. But I think that question of sort of what parents are willing to do for their children is really interesting. I think that reverberates throughout the book. And what I did was I started writing these pages of just Luke's mother's life. Like, what was she like as a child? What was she like when she was a teenager? How did she meet her husband? And started thinking about all the backstory of how this woman came to be who she was. And it actually ended up having a lot of empathy for her because she's a difficult character. She could very easily be this sort of Lady Macbeth, sort of, you know, pulling the strings type of character. But I thought about pastors' wives and how a lot of these women, at least from the outside looking in, I think of all of the pressure that's on you to be a certain type of woman, and the fact that this is a woman who, again, does a lot of work, doesn't get much recognition for it, and is kind of shoehorned into this role that she may or may not want to be part of. So when I started thinking about her life and her backstory, I also started thinking about why she would particular, she's kind of the person who makes the decision for them to pay for it, and I started thinking about why she would do that. And I think, you know, again, like, every sort of villainous character is a hero in their own minds, and I think that's what makes an interesting villain. I don't believe that these, you know, people are just like, oh, what can I get into today? Like that type of a cartoon. You know, I don't really believe in that, or I don't find it interesting if that person exists somewhere. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I thought from her point of view, now that I've spent some time in her skin, why is she thinking that this is a good idea? And I actually think she makes some kind of compelling arguments as far as this girl already wants to have an abortion. Like, actually, the good thing to do would be to help her. So there's a way in which she can rationalize it so that this is a decision that she can kind of live with. But I think, again, like, thinking of her point of view and why this makes sense for her, to me, that was what made that decision so much more interesting than people are hypocrites.
Mm. And her, I'm pretty sure her, Luke's father says we owe her. For, you know, for Luke's freedom, in a sense,
right.
too.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, what a perspective.
You know? Yeah, and also the sense that, you know, Nadia does go on to have a pretty good life. Like, she does the things that she wants to do. She's not damaged from this. But at the same time, again, Luke's mother, she's not really operating out of a desire to do what's best for Nadia. She's trying to do what's best for Luke.
Of course, yeah. I'm glad we came to Nadia because I love her and I love her friendship with Aubrey in particular. And I've heard you say that Nadia's story originally sat in the background. It kind of came forward over time. How did that choice unfold and what was it about the character that made you want to sort of bring her into focus?
I think it was kind of her unlikability that made me interested in her. I think Aubrey is really easy to like and she's easy to empathize with. And I think Nadia is a lot more prickly. So the fact that I kind of resisted her and kind of didn't even like her at first made her really interesting to me and made me want to explore that character more. But I think it was also realizing that in those early drafts, the abortion was also revealed at the very end, and it was this the secret that had kind of been simmering, and then, you know, the payoff was really terrible. But again, realizing that, no, this is actually the engine driving this forward. This gives this whole story meaning. This makes it interesting. So both moving that decision forward chronologically and also bringing that character to the forefront made it more interesting to me.
Mm. Writing female friendship is a huge topic. What do your friends think of the novel? What part of your friendships kind of went into considering
question.
These guys?
I don't know if I've been asked this question before. I don't know. I think that the sort of passion of friendship was something that felt very real to me, particularly when you're younger. Because I remember being in middle school or high, like when I was in like elementary school and middle school, I would get home from school and call my friends on the phone. Like, what did we have to talk about?
Yeah,
my mom would be like, you just saw her. Yeah. Why are you calling? But it would feel that important. And I remember there would be times
at that point we occupied the phones
right,
as well.
Exactly. Tying up the phone line.
Yeah.
And I remember also getting in arguments with my friends. And if like we didn't talk one day at school, it would just be so devastating that we're in a fight. So I wanted to find a way, you know, versus now where I'm like, you know, I have friends that I won't see for months and that's just kind of how life is. So I wanted to find a way to sort of capture that and that passion, that intensity of this friendship, and also think about the way that it changes as these girls grow into women, you get older. You know, I think about the friends I have now. I don't have a lot of friends who are married yet, but that's something that changes your friendship, or people start to have kids, that changes your friendship. So I tried to think about how to kind of distill that weird, intense passion of friendship when you're in high school and think of how that might change over time.
Hmm. Do you think it's peculiar to female friendship in some way? Or
I have no basis of comparison,
yeah.
But I'm kind of inclined to say yes. Mm. But I don't know. It's strange. I don't remember like having really any other sort of relationships that intense as when I was, me and my friends and our bond when we were young. So
you went to Michigan University like Nadia?
Yes.
I'm interested when kind of constructing this character, how much of yourself you wanted to put in or not,
yeah.
And if you thought about that, because it's something that is it's the cliche for a debut writer in particular.
I mean, not much. I think the geography of it is, so I grew up in Oceanside, so did she, both went to Michigan, but not much is really there. I think this ambition is me. I think the restlessness is also kind of me. I was like the only person in my family to kind of go away for college.
Were the first to travel overseas.
Yes, first to travel overseas. So those types of things I've always been kind of like, okay, what's next? So that type of restlessness, I think, is me.
Good. I'm glad that it's there because it's not always written about a sort of an unembarrassed ambition, I guess, for young women in particular.
Yeah, I think so. I don't know. The town I grew up in, there were so many people who generations of their family had lived there. They were kind of those types of people, and then they were like the military families who would come and go and come and go. And I was neither, because we weren't a military family, and also my parents had both come from other places. But at the same time, I also was always so terrified of being stuck there. And, you know, I like sometimes imagine this other version of my life where I never left Oceanside, and I'm like married to a Marine right now, and I'm just like working, I don't know, doing what. But I always felt like if I stayed, I would just be stuck. And I think that's part of why I've always been like looking, what's the next thing? What's the next thing?
Luke's response to the abortion begins as a pretty stereotypical one. But as a character, he evolves like kind of hugely. And we come to understand something that I'd never really contemplated, which is the male experience of abortion. Can you tell me a little bit about the role that gender expectations play for the characters in the novel?
Yeah, I mean, I think that evolution was also something that happened over drafts because Luke became a more complicated character. When I started to think, like, what if Luke is the one who really regrets the abortion and not Nadia? And it was weird writing it because it's not a perspective that I spend a lot of time dwelling in when I think about abortion rights or that whole conversation. And I also had to go down many wormholes of the internet. She took me to some pretty dark places of, you know, this sort of, I don't know, kind of like the men's right activists sort of. Right. I don't think the term was that then, but the sort of men's right activists of like, this is why women should not have abortions because you're a man and this is your baby and she's killing your baby. Took me down that wormhole, and I think there's one character that kind of represents that view, but Luke is really bothered by it because he doesn't go that far with it. But I started thinking about not necessarily that nastiness, but just this feeling of loss that Luke has, which while it's not a perspective I spend a lot of time in, I've empathized with the sense that he kind of feels like he was not allowed to make a decision and that someone made this decision for him and it was out of his hands. And that's really complicated, you know, politically and all of those ways because it's not his body. But at the same time, I think that feeling of loss is something that I empathize with. And I think it's unexpected because Luke is so irresponsible and he should not be anybody's father. Like, it's a terrible idea that he has that he could raise a baby. But at the same time, there was something to me that was kind of almost like wholesome about that he thinks that he could. And the idea that he wants to have this family with Nadia, that, you know, he's not super close to his own parents, but he wants to be somebody's dad. So yeah, it took some work for me to get Luke there because originally he was just kind of this asshole, but I wanted him to be more complicated and I wanted to sort of take that character in a more complex direction.
To go in a completely different direction, I read a really great interview on LitHub where the interviewer noted that there was a connection between your really widely read essay about on good white people and the kind of concept of goodness in this book too, and the way people kind of strive and then fail to achieve it. Can you tell us a little bit about the idea of goodness in your writing?
Well, it's a big question.
It's a big one.
I don't know. I guess not to sound cheesy, but I don't know. I think I generally believe that people try to be good. I say this like hesitantly, but I think that's the way I'm generally oriented, is to thinking that people try to be good. And again, that sense of the villain thinks that he's a hero. Like, I do think even people who do terrible things, I think that they think often that they're doing the right thing. But again, that's kind of the question of the essay, is if you think you're doing a right thing, but you harm somebody, does it matter that you tried to do the right thing, right? So I guess that's kind of what I think in my fiction, and I think those types of characters are interesting, people who are striving to do well but fail, because I think there's something really human about that and relatable, and it's kind of how I see the world. But I think with that essay, again, I'm questioning intentionality, because I think there's a way in which intentionality sometimes can be a crutch. I think sometimes people can get a free pass because, oh, well, I meant well. And again, it doesn't really matter what you mean if, you know, intentions aren't magic. Like, just because you mean well, if you still hurt someone, you should be held accountable for hurting that person.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, and you'll never truly know anyone's intentions.
Exactly, and you can't know them.
You can only see action.
Exactly.
Yeah. Hmm. So your essays... I strongly encourage you to seek out Brit's essays because they're fantastic, and they are much more overtly political than your fiction writing, which is sort of interesting because that non-fiction part of your practice came as somewhat of a surprise to you. You thought you were a novelist. I was talking to Santilla Chingapi yesterday about whether making art for art's sake is ultimately something that... broadly, people with a lot of privilege get to do. And we were asking ourselves whether it's possible to not be political if you are a woman, a person of colour, from any kind of position other than a white man. And because your identity and your politics is always part of everything. What do you think?
I think all art is political.
Yeah.
And I don't like speaking in absolutes, but yeah. I feel pretty confident about that. You know, it's like...
But on this, here's one. Here's an absolute.
Well, it's like, I mean, okay, Sex and the City, right? Like,
yeah.
Sex and the City is political. It's like you have these four rich white ladies living in New York, and there are no people of color around. That's shaping a vision of power and identity about a work, and that's as political as any, you know, black movie or black TV show or whatever. I think the difference is whose work is read as political. I think that's the big difference, is the way that readers respond to your work and who, you know, and this is something I've noticed of writers who are often white and male will get questions about craft, and I will get questions about identity. So people rarely ask me questions about technique. Like, you've asked, like, oh, how did you do this? How did you decide to do that? I've done events where people will not ask me about that. They will ask me about identity. And I've been on done events with white men and seen that they get questions about craft. So I think things like that is sort of what perpetuates the idea that this work is political and this work is not political.
Yeah.
But if you're writing about people have bodies. Bodies are race, they're gendered, they have levels of ability. Politics is about bodies and people and who has what type of power. So I think it's all political. I just think the difference is whose work is viewed that way.
So it's more in the reception.
I think so, yeah. Yes.
You wrote a critique of Ta-Nehisi Coates in The New Yorker. And what was really refreshing about it for me was it was a really graceful critique, and it was really far away from the kind of, I guess, cultural criticism, if you want to call it that, that we get a lot online these days, which is like, this is shit and this is a hero, you know, like,
yeah.
And there's nothing between those two kinds of things, and it kind of dominates our discourse a lot. What do you make of our kind of critical context at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know... I mean, I think Jon Stewart did a thing about this on The Daily Show once. I remember we talked about, like, the headlines of when anyone disagrees, where it'll be like, so-and-so eviscerates so-and-so, or so, you know, Michelle Obama slams Donald Trump. There's always that framing of aggression and violence when people disagree. And I think there's a way in which the news and the internet culture, it feeds into that. It's like professional wrestling or boxing or something, where you feed into this person battling that person. And I think, you know, really good criticism is about expanding how someone views a work. It's not necessarily about telling them if the work is good or bad, or what's bad about it or what's good about it. And that was also a book I really did enjoy. And I felt honestly very worried to critique it because...
Fair enough.
Right. I mean, yeah. At the time, all of the pieces that had come out about it were glowing.
And huge.
Right.
Yeah.
And it was a huge book. My book had not come out yet. So nobody, I was like, I don't want people to think I'm some, you know, person who's kind of latching on to
battle.
Trying to throw the pebble at Goliath to, you know, get some attention for my own book. And also, I mean, I think being a Black person and knowing how hugely important this book was about race, there was that feeling of not wanting to tear it down, blah, blah, blah. But at the same time, I knew that that wasn't my reading of it. I didn't think the book was terrible. I didn't have major critiques. I just thought that Ta-Nehisi Coates had blind spots, which he has admitted himself. And I wanted to point those out and think about how we could enlarge the conversation that he began. So I think that that's what the criticism I enjoy does. It's not this takedown wrestling sort of mentality. It's actually engaging with the work thoughtfully and expanding the way that I, as the reader or the viewer, see it.
Absolutely. And I mean, similarly, I guess a similar kind of trajectory of bodies and female bodies, you in the New Republic, you sort of wrote about the dominant slave narratives that have characterized American writing and screen culture. And you, I guess, it gently kind of reinserted the female experience again. When you think about, I guess, not the book that you've written, but future fiction writing, what's the relationship between the kinds of ideas that you can argue for in a more rhetorical way in nonfiction, and then how that, you know, then kind of filters in some way to the more poetic of prose?
Yeah, I mean, I think one is just time, because with the essays, usually there's a sense of like something being timely or not being timely. So I remember I wrote an essay about American Girl dolls, and it wasn't really about American Girl dolls. It was really about Black childhood and innocence. It was about how I had this doll her backstory was that she was an escaped slave. And I thought about the fact that I had this doll when I was little. I was young enough to think that Santa Claus brought her to me, but somehow old enough to have a doll who was a slave. So I was thinking about like that contradiction and everything. And I remember there was one publication I will not name who we sent the essay to, and they were just like, nah, it's not timely. We don't really want it. And it ended up doing pretty well. It was a piece that got a lot of attention. But again, because it wasn't about, oh, American Girl dolls are in the news right now. It was, and I think part of that is the internet and the sense of, you know, everyone wants something that people are talking about right now. But for me, that was a really huge question about Black childhood, because you have Black children being killed by police. And who gets to be a child? Who gets to be innocent? To me, that's forever a timely question. But yeah, I think that's some of the issue with writing nonfiction, and particularly writing online. You know, I think now I can't imagine what it would be like now to write a piece that's not about Trump. I mean, I don't know if anyone is interested in anything like that. So yeah, I think so. That's one thing. I think the other thing is like with a novel, if the novel is a marriage, you're going to be working with that idea for so long. So it has to be something I'm really excited about and something that really perplexes me and challenges me. But I think with both things, I don't want to know what I think about it from the onset. If I know what I think about it already, it's a tweet. It's not an essay. It's not a novel.
We're going to be coming to your questions pretty soon, so get them ready. I wanted to ask you that it's a really complicated question, this one.
Okay.
If you had to choose a character in Parks and Recreation, which one it would be?
Like my favorite character?
Yeah, because when we think about goodness, you know, you'd mentioned the other night in our event at the Comedy Theater that was one of your favorite shows.
I mean, okay, I obviously love Leslie Knope, but I think Ron Swanson is probably my favorite. And like, you know, and I think because he has that wall up that he tries to keep but gets broken down in spite of himself over and over again, that's something that I actually find really touching and really funny.
Alrighty, we might open it out for you guys to answer some questions. I think our ushers will come to you if you want to put some hands up.
Hi, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the Mother's screen adaptation by Kerry Washington. And my second question is, what are you working on next?
Okay, so sort of the second question is, I'm working on the screenplay right now. but I started a second novel that's really early, very rough. So I'm kind of balancing those two projects right now. As far as the screen adaptation, we're still in a really early stage because I have not written it yet. I'm supposed to be working on that this week, but I've been swept up in the insanity of the Sydney Writers Festival. Fun insanity, but insanity. So I'm right now I'm at the outline stage, but it's cool. Kerry Washington's really excited about the project, and the studio seems excited about the project. And you never know what these adaptations, you know, movies never get made. But it's been fun for me so far to try to work in a new form and try to think of a way to transform this story from one on the page to the screen.
What do you think might change about in that process? Is it too soon to tell?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because I think for me there's sort of a pleasure of getting a chance to right the wrongs of the book with the movie.
We don't think there are wrongs.
I can tell you many, but I have a lot of regrets of things that, like, oh, I wish I would have changed this. I wish I would have done this differently. So there's a way in which I kind of feel that pleasure of getting to go back and change it. But I don't know. I think right now there, one thing is I wish there had been a scene with later in the book with Nadia, Luke, and Aubrey all together, and they kind of can avoid each other. I kind of gave them an easy out where they can avoid each other. So I'm trying to write a scene where they're forced to be together. It's going to be super awkward. and I think that's one big thing so far. But the other thing is just figuring out how to take the interiority and make it visual, what you do with backstory. So it's not just expository dialogue of someone being like, oh, I'm so sorry, your mother committed suicide. You know, like, how do you convey that information? That to me has been the difficult thing of not having this just easy narrator can just tell you everything. So those are the big things I'm thinking about right now.
We never do learn why Nadia's mother commits suicide. I can't ask you why, but or can I? But what was the decision to not reveal that? You know, to keep something.
Yeah, I mean, I just thought I went back and forth. There were sometimes I was like, maybe she finds a suicide note, and I actually had a section I wrote from her dead mother's point of view, like from beyond the grave. Which I had to cut because my editor is like, what is this? and I was kind of like, I was kind of thinking about that scene in Beloved where like Beloved narrates from the grave. And then my editor's just like, you're not Toni Morrison. Like, what are you doing? So,
but you tried, and I think it's awesome.
I tried, but yeah, I got cut. So maybe in the paperback there'll be an extended edition, like bonus track. But that was one thing where I tried to. But I think ultimately I was kind of cheesy if she finds like some nice neat explanation, because I think that's what's so tragic about suicide is that you don't know, and the fact that she is forced to live with that wondering forever, and also to wonder if she is partly responsible for her mother's decision in her own life. To me, that was something that was really heartbreaking.
It is heartbreaking, that's for sure.
Hi. I guess, how do you decide when a work's finished, especially with a work like The Mothers that you said you started in your teens, and any advice for young writers?
How do I decide when the book is finished? Was that the question?
Yeah.
Especially when you're writing it for quite a long time.
Right. Well, with this, it was like I had my friends read it, and they were just like, it's done. Like, send it to somebody. So I had to be really prodded, because I would still be working on it today, probably, if my friends had not been like, send it to an agent. It's good.
Who are those trusted readers and friends?
Well, okay, so my friend Chris McCormick, he has a book out called Desert Boys, and it's amazing. So Chris McCormick and Mairead Smallstage, she writes these really amazing essays on country music and professional wrestling. So they're both geniuses, and also really great supportive friends who read a rough draft of this and encouraged me to send it off. So I had them in my corner to kind of prod me with the second book. I guess my agent is probably just going to hassle me until I give it to her. So I'm just a person who's going to tinker with something forever. So I guess I kind of need that external pressure to let go.
He also wondered about advice for young writers.
Oh, my advice, I guess I don't have great advice. I think read, write, I think be patient with yourself. Because I love that Ira Glass quote where he talks about how the problem with young artists is that like your taste level is really here and your skill level is here, and the problem is getting from here to here, and that's where people quit. So it's like having to be patient until your talent level actually meets your taste level. And I think that that's something I had to work on doing with this book, because I hated every single draft of this book that I wrote. And still to this day, we'll look at that book and be like, oh, I want to change so much. So I think it's good to have good taste, and that's what makes you want to be an artist, but having to actually just be patient and forgive yourself when your talent level falls below your taste, which it will most times.
And you're trying to write a dead mother. And
yeah, yeah, and it's not as good as Toni Morrison.
Next question, up the back.
Hey, Britt.
Hi.
As a fellow quarter-life crisis survivor, an aspiring author, how has your life changed since you've published your first book?
Wow. I'm doing things like this. I'm in Australia. That's wild. It's funny because in the day-to-day, it's like, I live in LA, nobody cares who I am. It's like Kardashians live here, nobody cares about my book. But then occasionally I get to do things like this that's really cool, and to talk to readers. I have readers hit me up on all types of social media, which is new. Like, I have people like go slide into my DMs on Twitter or Instagram and want to talk to me about the book, which I always just used Instagram to look at like puppy videos, and now people want to talk to me about the book. So that's new.
And do you enjoy it, or is it a strange?
It can be a little overwhelming sometimes, yeah. Just because I feel like writers now are kind of asked to be more accessible than before social media. This woman wrote me on Facebook and was like, can you come to my book club? Those types of things where it's hard. It's kind of hard to separate like your personal, and it wasn't like my author Facebook. It was like my personal Facebook that she found. So it's kind of hard to separate that, like where you go to play and just sort of versus kind of your professional life. So I think that can be weird. But at the same time, I'm just really grateful that I've been able to travel more. I've traveled more in this past year than I ever had in my entire life, both around the United States and around the world. I've had opportunities to write different things, had publications approach me to write, where most of the time you're just like begging for someone to say yes to you. So all of that has been really exciting and really new.
In all those travels, what has the reception to the book been like in different places? Has it varied a lot?
It's been really warm everywhere, and I feel really grateful for that. I had a lot of, I didn't have that much anxiety until I started to think about some of the places I was traveling. Like, the first time in the tour, I went to like these really liberal areas like Portland and Brooklyn. And then the second time they were like, okay, we're going to send you to Wichita, Kansas, and to talk about abortion. And that's where I started to be like, okay, I don't know how this is gonna go. But I went there, and there's this room full of women who wanted to talk to me about the book and were so excited and warm and interested in the book. So I think in a lot of ways, it's the travel has sort of upended a lot of my expectations about politics and who my readers will be. And all of these things that I sort of assumed of who would like the book. And it's been so exciting. The book is being published in Turkey, where it's not legal for women to have abortions. So the idea of the book being transferred across language and culture is completely unexpected, but really exciting.
Does it feel strange to be... I was listening to an interview you did where you were talking about going to England to study, and it was the first time that people were like, hey, American, tell us comprehensively how American politics work. And you're like, But these days, ABC News Breakfast, when you Googled you yesterday morning, it was like, Britt Bennett on Trump.
oh, God, is that what it said?
not quite that, but pretty much.
Yeah.
How have you, especially, I guess, from the perspective of a young writer, now you have, you do have something to say,
yeah.
And you need to have something to say.
Yes.
What's that experience been like?
Well, I mean...
Whether it's abortion or Trump,
right.
Or issues, I guess.
I don't know. I think the Trump thing, I have mixed feelings about it, because on one hand, I just really reject this idea that all of my intellectual and artistic energy should be spent thinking about this terrible person. the same time, he's a terrible person, and I'm very happy to say it anywhere I go, honestly. So I talked about it in Italy. I've talked about it here. I was on Twitter yesterday or the other day, and I was like, yeah, my goal is to insult Trump on every continent. So got three down. I'm, you know, someone needs to send me, you know, everywhere. I will do
this
gladly.
Just do that.
Yes.
Do that.
So, you know, I mean, I think... it's important to pay attention to the political moment you're in. I think I don't like the idea of writers, you know, sticking your head in the sand. And again, this idea that your art can be divorced from the politics, I don't believe that. And the same thing with abortion rights. It's an extremely fraught political thing to be in Kansas and talk about abortion. Particularly in the United States right now, where so many states are trying to curtail abortion rights in all of these different ways. So I think that I can't escape the politics of the moment. I don't particularly want to escape them. I like to engage with them, but at the same time, I think about what Toni Morrison said when she says that the function of racism is distraction. It distracts you from your work because you're constantly trying to prove. Somebody says, oh, black people aren't smart, and you're trying to prove, no, we are, no, we are. And it's like, obviously we are. You're spending time doing that. And there's a sense in which I kind of feel the same way about Trump, and I feel the same way about some of these other things. Like, I'm not going to spin my wheels arguing with people about Trump when I know the reality of how terrible a leader he is. I'm not going to shy away from that, but at the same time, I'm here to write books, I'm here to do my work, and I'm not here to spend all my energy thinking about him.
Next question.
Yeah.
I was wondering about what it was like to write the book while studying writing, in a way, and that process of, you know, going through your university degree and learning about the craft of writing and where you're placed in terms of your voice, in terms of how you want to write, and going through the process of writing a novel throughout that, and how that might influence the way that you write your next novel.
That's a really good question. I think, I don't know, I found it helpful in a sense to read so many great books and read so many interesting writers. Whenever I'm blocked, I read. Because another thing Toni Morrison has said is that... just channel
I don't
her.
Think you need to be like embarrassed about quoting Toni Morrison.
Another thing Toni Morrison said. She said, you know, you're not writer's block, like... you're not blocked, you're empty. So when you're feeling writer's block, it's because you are empty. Maybe you need to go take a walk, maybe you need to look at a painting, watch a movie, read a book, but you need to in sort of immerse yourself in something else. And often I'll be reading other people's work and solve a problem in my mind of my own book. So in that sense, it was really great to be in school. I was in a workshop which has its pros and cons, I would say. The pros are that you have really smart people reading your work, and that's hard to do, find readers. So many times I remember in my life where I've been like, oh, I have a story, friend, will you read it for me? And they're like, yeah, I'll read it, and of course never get to it. So to have these people who are smart and good writers and forced to read your work, that was great. At the same time, there were so many voices in the room. And not just the voice of the writer you were reading, but also just the voices of the people in your workshop. And over time, that just wore away at me. I just wanted to shut out those voices and do my own thing. And I'm glad to be away from a workshop now. I don't really want to join a writer's group or anything because I'm tired of all of those voices in the room. And I like the ability now with this next book to just to be sit there with my own voice and try to figure out what to do and how to move forward. I think it was a good experience in that sense, but I'm also kind of glad to be outside of an academic environment and just to be there with the blank page.
Can you tell us what the next book is about, broadly? Do you have those words yet?
Not really.
Yeah.
I really still don't know who these people are or what they're doing. But broadly, it's about twin sisters who are estranged. It opens in 1950s Louisiana.
That's
as far
that's
as I know.
That's what you know so far.
Yeah, it's rough.
Good. Next question.
It's a great pleasure to hear you. And I was wondering, you were saying about how you started to write in the voice of an older person. How do you catch that and keep that voice over a long time? Do you sort of have prompts like music or a poem? Because I sometimes find like that voice will waver and it sort of dissipates.
That's a really good question. I mean, I think a lot of it was editing. But also there's a way I think the book, it cheats a little bit because the whole book is not really written in that voice. And part of that I think was I had those questions of how to sustain it and if it would be interesting to sustain it. So I gave myself these sort of bursts where that language became really interesting and became really focal, focused on that space. But I think a lot of it for me is just kind of editing, just to write in that voice as long as you can. And when you go back and edit, find when that voice wavers and cut it. Thank you.
It's hard.
It's hard. Yeah, yeah, I haven't thought about that. Yeah.
Next question.
Do you have a place or location that you like to write from, a particular environment?
Did everyone hear that it was whether you have a place or location that you like to write from?
I just like coffee shops. I used to be very precious and I have to stay inside where it's quiet. And then I reached a point where I actually kind of liked the background noise. I liked seeing people. I don't like libraries, writing in libraries, because they're so quiet. So I like the idea of going to a coffee shop, and it just kind of depends where I am. I used to write in this coffee shop called Espresso Royale, in Ann Arbor. One of Ann Arbor's finest coffee shops. And the one I went to, it was so terrible. It was really dark and gross in there. And everybody hated, like, nobody liked to write in there but me. And I loved it because I didn't have, there was, like, a really cool, there were, like, really cool, like, hip coffee shops. And I was like, I don't like going there. I want to go to the weird, dark one.
Where they don't mind you sitting there
for
several
hours. Yeah, where I can sit there for
hours
and nobody bothers me and I never see anyone I know. So that was my place, and before I left, I bought a mug from there. So now I still drink out of that mug as a reminder of all the time I spent.
Maybe that's how you capture the voice.
Yeah, that summons the voice from Espresso Royale. Yes.
Next question.
Hi. Thank you. I really love this book, and one of the things that I loved, in addition to the writing, is the cover. And I wondered what your relationship with the cover is, and do you like it, and why?
Thank you. I love the cover. I got really lucky with it. Most writers, I think, have no say when it comes to your cover. And with this cover in particular, I got an email one day from my editor who was just like, we saw the book cover. It's stunning. It's the best thing we've ever seen, blah, blah, blah. And I'm thinking like, oh, God, what if I don't like it? And she says, there's so many colors on it. It's so bright. We don't want you to see it on a computer screen. We want you to see it in person. So I'm like, okay. So she's like, we're going to mail you a paper printout of the cover so you can see what it'll look like. So I'm like, okay, I live in LA, so they're in New York. So I wait like 5 days for this to ship across the country. My agent actually gets it before I do, and she sends me an email that just says, subject line, call me as soon as you see it, and that's all it says. So I'm thinking, oh, God, it's so ugly, and I'm going to be stuck with this cover. And then I get it and it's amazing. And I was like, why did you send me that cryptic email? She's like, oh yeah, I love it too. I just, you know. So I spent a week feeling a lot of anxiety about the fact that I might have an ugly cover, and it's beautiful. So the designer's name is Rachel Wiley, and she's very talented. The best story I heard about it, I have a friend who teaches kindergarten, and he said that his students pulled the book out of his bag and were looking at it, and they can't even read, but they were just drawn to the colors on the cover of the book. And I think that's a testament to the fact that there's something arresting about it. Yeah, thank you.
Next question.
Hi, Britt. It's really great to hear you speak. You spoke about the character of Nadia coming forward, and you didn't realise that she would have, you know, such a pivotal role within the book. Were there any characters that came to you where you kind of thought, oh, you're not for this one, you're for another book?
Oh, that's interesting.
That's a really good question. I don't think anyone from this book, but, I mean, this is completely unhelpful because I'm being vague about the second book, but there's a character in the second book who emerged from a short story I had written and worked on in grad school. And in that short story, this character just had, I mean, was just very downtrodden and had a lot of just really bad luck and never really had any victories. So he reappears in this novel and actually has a really nice love story and a really nice personal arc. So it was a character I really liked, and I was like, that wasn't right how I treated him. So he's had a second life in this the second book. So it'll be fun to see what the people from my workshop who read that story, they're going to see this character and being repurposed in a new way. Yeah.
We were talking backstage about a Netflix series, Dear White People, and which I don't know if people have seen, but it is, well, maybe you can describe it. I was fascinated because I'd seen you make some kind of light commentary on social media, and I wanted to know what you really thought of it. But we were talking, I guess, about colorism in particular,
right?
And the portrayal of that in television, in pop culture.
Right.
And I thought that it might be interesting to share that kind of experience, because I think it's not dissimilar to the kinds of conversations we have in Australia between different kinds of immigrant experiences.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if anyone's seen Dear White People, the show. It was also a film. I did not love the show, but thought it was I didn't think it was a great show, but I enjoyed watching it in that type of way. but yeah, I mean, I think actually the question of colorism, that's one of the things that my next book is about. I guess that's another thing I can say. I know that vaguely, but this idea of dark skin and light skin and the ways that light skin is privileged in probably most cultures. My mom's from Louisiana, and there my mom is much lighter than I am, but grew up feeling like the dark-skinned person in her family. And when she told me that, it blew my mind, because she's not at all what I imagine as dark skin. But the sense of color and the way she had, one of my aunts is extremely fair, has red hair, and she talked about how there were some people in the neighborhood who would always invite that aunt to come over and play and would never invite my mother, even though they were around the same age, because she was lighter and fairer and everything. So yeah, there's kind of a sort of underlying commentary in that show, but it's something that I am interested in for the next novel, and the ways in which color is privileged or not privileged, guess that's what I'll say.
Yeah, I mean, there's a strong discussion about Indigenous Australians here, particularly those who have fairer skin. We have a lot of Indigenous writers, very high profile. I'm thinking of like Anita Heiss, whose book "Am I Black Enough for You?" is part of a sort of big discussion about who gets to determine someone else's race or culture or the way they are perceived, and especially it shouldn't be white men.
Right. And I just think about, you know, I don't have any identities that are really necessarily ambiguous. Like, I've never been mistaken for another race.
Sure.
I've never been able to sort of choose how I identify. But I think that's another thing I'm interested in. What types of identities are sort of mutable? Who are the types of people who can choose what they want to identify as, and who are the people who can't choose? And I think there are a lot of ways in which, I think identity is such an interesting thing, because it is so broad, and there are so many identities that are transformed, and that people can transform between them, and other identities that are sort of static. So what do you do with those categories, the ones that are static or the ones that change? So that's, I guess, what the book is also about, sort of transformation. I'm just saying abstract concepts, because that's where I am with the book.
Somehow it'll end.
Yeah, somehow. Oh,
thank you for being so generous to share something that is so, early days with us. And thank you so much for writing such a beautiful novel.
Thank you.
It's obviously affected a huge group of Australians as well as people overseas. Yes. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks, and everyone, for coming out. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing, and ideas from Melbourne, Australia, and the world.